I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. In a ceremony at the White House last night, President Joe Biden spoke about the nation's collective pain as we mourn 500,000 deaths from disease related to COVID-19. Today on Midday, lessons on dying and grieving. Polls show that 80% of Americans would prefer to die at home, but only 20% actually do. Dr. Dan Morheim and the artist Shelley Morheim have created a roadmap that all of us can follow to control, to some extent, the circumstances surrounding our passing and that of our loved ones. Their book is called Preparing for a Better End. Plus, a former Harvard psychologist, Dr. Dorothy Hollinger, on navigating the grieving process during the pandemic. First, the news. And good afternoon. Welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Very glad you're with us. Last night, President Biden addressed the nation as we passed the grim milestone of 500,000 deaths from illness related to COVID-19. 500 candles were placed on the steps of the White House commemorating the loved ones who have been lost. Flags will fly at half-mast for the next 5 days. Because of the pandemic, most of the deceased were denied the honor of a memorial service or funeral that included extended family and friends. The pandemic has changed many things, including how we grieve. The pandemic has perhaps also forced our attention on the need to anticipate and navigate end-of-life issues in a way that we weren't focused pre-COVID. Conversations about how to plan for the end of our lives and the lives of those we love are conversations that many of us are reluctant to have. We talk a lot about the wonders and joy of birth. Books that celebrate the critical and life-changing step into parenthood abound. Birth is, of course, a fundamental dimension of the human experience, but so is death. And our timidity and queasiness to talk about it are understandable. But we can have agency when it comes to decisions surrounding our final passage. My first guests today have written a book about those decisions. Dr. Dan Morheim is an emergency medicine physician who served in the Maryland legislature for 24 years. Shelley Morheim is a filmmaker and a therapeutic music practitioner for hospice and hospital patients. Their new book is called Preparing for a Better End: Expert Lessons on Death and Dying for You and Your Loved Ones. Dan and Shelley Morheim join us on Zoom. Welcome.
Glad to be with you.
Thank you, Tom.
So, Dan, you guys wrote a book on this very subject 10 years ago. Why did you decide to write another one 10 years later? And what has changed in the data, the study, the understanding of issues around death and dying?
The situation is, of course, still the same, that not enough Americans have engaged in advanced care planning. And if you go to ask anybody the question, I ask any of the listeners, I know we all know this is a hard topic, but this is about empowerment and practical steps you can take right now for no cost in order to have a better end of life experience for your loved ones or for yourself, depending on how you want to look at it. And if you ask yourself this question, where would you like to be in the last days, hours, minutes of your life? It's a 5-second exercise. Most people answer the same thing: at home with my family and friends around me. Nobody says killed in a fiery car crash or dying in a hospital long past any hope of recovery, although we all want the best of what modern medicine has. So what our book is about is, yes, we're all going to die. We face the inevitable. But this is about empowerment and values, compassion, respect, and dealing with the things most of us fear, which is pain, isolation, and dependency.
And Shelley Morheim, you spend a fair amount of time as an artist, as a musician, with people who are in the final passages, the final stages of their lives. Do they talk to you about those issues? As Dan said, you know, the questions you ask, where do you want to be? Who is there with you? What's going on while you're passing? What would you want in your last months or weeks or even hours? What sort of care do you want, and what fits in your worldview? Are these things, are these conversations you've had with the patients you've worked with?
No, because the patients I'm working with are usually very close to the end. So, you know, it's beyond that. Although I will say how much I play the folk harp for patients in hospitals and hospice. And it's just so touching to see how the music affects people. Your analogy to the birth process, that is a moment of transition, you know, into life. And the moment of transition out of life is just as meaningful and profound and, you know, emotionally gripping. It's, you know, usually when you're playing for somebody who's actively dying, you're not even playing melodies or anything that has a rhythm, but just disconnected chords and notes. And it's almost like you can feel them floating away on those notes. It's just it's a beautiful thing. And for the families that are there, they can feel it too. I mean, music, you know, touches us in literally in our bodies as well as our hearts and minds. So it's been a privilege to do that. But I would say, you know, music is one example of something that, you know, you can, when people fill out advanced directives, one of the questions that's brought up is what kinds of care do you want? And specifically, you might want to say, I would like music, or I would, you know, this is my favorite kind of music and I would like it to be playing. I would like to be taken outdoors. I would like, you know, my dog to stay with me. What, it's very personal, which is, I think why we, you know, one of the impetuses for writing the book is we can, as individuals, we can really begin to think about what we would want and then actually get it. Because if you don't, you know, the lesson is always, if you don't make those decisions, somebody will make them for you. And it may not be what you want.
Yeah, and that's a good point. And Dan, you talk a lot in this book, throughout the book, about the importance of advance directives. So you can literally direct with the kind of care you want, the people you want making decisions, who those people should consult with before they make decisions, what you want to do with your body after you die, what do you want to spend on disposal of your body or interment of your body, do you want to donate your organs, and then, you know, as Shelley's mentioning, even things about music and the, you know, the physical environment of where you are at the time of your passing. Advance directives are legal in all 50 states. Talk about how they have evolved. Talk about where things stand overall with the formulation of advance directives. These, I take it, are not things that need to be done by an attorney or something. I mean, this is something that people can do pretty much on their own, right?
Absolutely, yes. And think of it this way. We're the first generation in human history that likely has some say about how we die. Up to now, you know, previous generations, you kind of got dealt your cards and that was it. But now, fortunately, thanks to modern medical science, which I love, people are living longer, happier, more productive lives. And so we can plan ahead for the end to come. And advance directives are the key tool. They're free legal documents. You don't need an attorney. They're available through a variety of sources. In Maryland, the state of Maryland, Attorney General's office has it. AARP has it. My personal favorite is called mydirectives.com. I have no connection with them except to admire their product, mydirectives.com. It's free and it's online. You can go through the whole form in about 15 minutes. You need to think about what you're going to complete for quite a bit longer, but you can update these forms at any time that you want. And not only can you specify the kinds of care and what you want around, you can put in other things. For example, if you have an annoying relative, you can say, please don't have Uncle Fred around when they're discussing my end of life care. You can specify the kinds of foods you want. But there's also practical things to take advantage of. Palliative care, which provides a lot of comfort, and it's not just about end of life or dying. And hospice care, which is really an amazingly comforting service that's provided for. And actually, people are entitled, and we pay for in our taxes, for 6 months of hospice service. But the average length of stay in hospice is typically only about 15 or 20 days. So we're not taking full advantage of programs that are available at no cost. And hospice provides a lot of comfort to the patient, a lot of guidance to the family. And, you know, I'd also ask listeners to think about this question. Other than in a professional experience, how many of us have actually been present when somebody took their last breath? And when I ask audiences that, very rarely, you know, only 10, 15, 20% have had that experience. So it's interesting that most of us are actually cut off from personal experience from this last transition. Of course, the other thing, my career as an ER doctor, 40 years frontline emergency medicine experience, I've also come to appreciate how completing advanced directives has saved families a great deal of turmoil about making decisions about end-of-life care for their loved one who's in an extreme state. And I could tell you a lot of stories about that. And if you allow me the time, I would tell you one that happened many years ago where an elderly woman came in and she had a major neurological catastrophe, a big stroke. It was quite obvious. We did the whole workup. The family came and they were getting a lot of arguments about some said, let grandma die in peace. And others said, do all you can for grandma. She had an advanced directive and it said, if I'm in extreme state with no hope of recovery, allow natural death. And so that's what we did. And when the when I went into the room to disconnect some of the medical equipment, I had the family come with me. And the fight that was going on completely evaporated. They came together around the head of the bed and sang songs and stroked her brow and said their goodbyes. And I've seen families at war decades later over these issues, and also families that were able to resolve because the individual person took the step to complete free paperwork.
Yeah, it's so, so important. Dr. Dan Morheim, he and Shelley Morheim are the authors of Preparing for a Better End, Expert Lessons on Death and Dying for You and Your Loved Ones. To join our conversation, we're at 410-662-8780. To send us an email, midday@wypr.org, and to tweet us, it's @midday WYPR. So Shelley, Dan writes about his experience in the legislature bringing up these topics. And he says that, you know, when he would bring these topics up and propose legislation around death and dying issues, it would give his fellow legislators the heebie-jeebies. This is just stuff people don't want to talk about. They don't want to think about. And I think that's natural. But having been in these situations when people are in their very last stages and having relationships with their families, what is your advice about how to bring these subjects up? Because as Dan says, you know, it's ever so important for people to be specific about what they would prefer, because it will really save families a whole lot of consternation and potential conflict. What are some of the tips you might give folks for how to introduce these difficult subjects?
Well, I guess that's a big reason why we wrote the book, is that we hope that the book, because it's written, we use stories to make a lot of these points, that people can, it's not a direct in-your-face approach. It's kind of saying, this is what has happened with other people and the different decisions that they made depending on their personal values and situations. I think it's a good, we've heard from a lot of folks that they've given copies of the book, you know, to relatives, and then it's sort of easier to get into that conversation, because you're, on the one hand, everybody sort of wants to have this conversation. Everybody's a little afraid of what could happen to them. But on the other hand, it can be, like you say, really tricky. And you don't want to force people into it. So it's kind of a, you know, a way to lead, you know, to get people to begin thinking about it. And it does take a certain amount of persistence, you know, in bringing it up. But like Dan was just saying with that story of the woman and her family, it's probably one of the greatest gifts we can give to our loved ones, is that we have thought about it and we have laid it out what we want. Because then they don't have to make those very difficult decisions in the middle of medical crises, which is the hardest time to do so, all on their own. They have the advice of the person that it most affects, and that really takes a huge burden off of folks.
It does indeed, and I can speak to that from personal experience. My father passed away 5 years ago, and when he was really pretty young, in his late 60s, he put together what he called the Blue Book, and the book had information about his insurance policies and sort of financial information. I'm the financial agent for my mom now. And so we had easy access to all of those records. But he also had things like the readings he wanted in his funeral mass and the person he wanted to say that mass and things like there was nothing left for us to decide. He had scripted it out, and thank God he lived until he was almost 89 years old. So this was something he did early on, and he would update it occasionally. But we had a really good roadmap, and it was a great gift that he gave to my mom and me and my brothers. Dan and Shelley Morheim are the authors of Preparing for a Better End, Expert Lessons on Death and Dying for You and Your Loved Ones. We'll take calls and comments when we return from a quick break. Our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
You're tuned to your NPR news station, 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow, there is a great distrust of medical research in communities of color. African Americans point to the Tuskegee experiments, or use of Henrietta Lacks's HeLa cells in cancer research, as part of the reason that they are reluctant to be vaccinated against the coronavirus. My guest tomorrow on Midday has written a disquieting book called Carte Blanche, The Erosion of Medical Consent, in which she writes about how medical consent has continued to be attenuated in recent decades. Harriet Washington joins me to talk about it tomorrow here on Midday. If you've just joined us today, my guests are Dr. Dan and Shelley Morheim, the authors of a new book called Preparing for a Better End, Expert Lessons on Death and Dying for You and Your Loved Ones. To join our conversation with the Morheims, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org. To tweet us, it's @MiddayWYPR. To tweet me, it's @TomHallWYPR. Let's go to the phones to Owen, who's calling from Germantown. Owen, welcome to Midday. Thanks for calling.
Sure. Firstly, it's Irwin, Dan. And the question I have is very difficult, but I think it's important. It's how do you feel about assisted suicide, which is legal in several states? It's a very difficult decision, but it can be an important decision.
Thank you. So first, let me say that I certainly get the intensity of that issue. Let me make this point, and actually, Tom, it goes to a little bit to your guest tomorrow. Only about 40% of Americans have completed advance directive, and it's about half that in the minority population. And so advance directives are a way to actually empower folks to not feel pushed around by the healthcare system. And if we raise that number from 40% and 20%, and formally identified in an article I wrote in the American Journal of Public Health as a minority health disparity, to 98%, I think a lot of the issues that assisted suicide issues or medical assisted dying would be addressed. Now, in the legislature, I did read the bill, and I probably would have ended up voting for the bill because there's always a few outlier cases. But let me give you the example of La Crosse, Wisconsin, which decided as a community with its faith community, business, medical, and a lot of advocates to have the conversation about end of life care, the one that most of us resist. And they have about a 98% completion rate of advanced directives. Not only did a lot of the social issues and the dynamic issues and the spiritual issues get much better addressed, they also reduced their healthcare costs. So I think for some outlier cases, as we wrote about in the book, medical dying ought to be reserved. But most of those issues that people are concerned about, isolation, control, empowerment, respect for values, and pain, can all be addressed through the completion of already free legal forms that have been around since 1990. but we avoid doing because we're so reticent to talk about this topic.
And Erwin, thank you for that call. Shelley Morheim, let's talk about the impact of the pandemic on the kind of work that you've been doing, being with patients. Dan mentioned isolation as one of the things that people are concerned about as they are making their final passage. Obviously, this has been a real issue for people dying of coronavirus or even dying of other diseases in hospitals where visitation is limited because of the pandemic. Have you been able to be present for people in their final moments during the pandemic? How has it changed the work that you do?
I have not been able to because the hospital has regulations that I'm hoping to, because I've now been vaccinated, so I'm hoping to get back to doing that soon. But you raise really great points. All the issues that people are concerned about are made worse by COVID. And actually, I'm going to let Dan take that because he's written a number of articles and about how this changes and what we can do to try and address some of these issues.
Well, the issues obviously dated predated COVID and will be around post-COVID, but COVID has made it worse for two main reasons. One is that people get respiratory symptoms and then often can't communicate as well or get put on ventilators, in which case they can't communicate at all verbally. And then secondly, families who we as a clinician relied to be at the bedside to guide us about the person and to tell us about them and help make medical decisions are not allowed in the institution at all. So it's made clinical decision-making harder, and it's made isolation in the hospital for obvious reasons more common. So all the more important to complete an advance directive in advance. Also, as a clinician, we don't always know who to speak to. Who did the patient designate? You can't always presume that it's the spouse or the adult children, or there may be several adult children. An advance directive allows that to be specified. So you could say, it's this person specifically that I want you to talk to, and you can discuss medical and private medical information with them. But otherwise, it's a guessing game, and that's not appropriate either.
And Dan, I'm interested that you write about the fact that physicians like yourself often anticipate an outcome for themselves that's different than what they recommend for their patients. What's the data show you about that?
Well, that is in the book, and there was one major study, and it shows something that I think anybody in the healthcare provider clinician side knows, that we sometimes do things to patients that we wouldn't choose for ourselves. And I've always tried to approach that when I'm taking care of patients and they ask me, should I have this done or not? I'll say, well, this is what I would do if it were me. Or the question patients should ask their clinicians is, would you do this procedure if it was you or your loved one? Would you have them be done? But it is a disconnect. And I think it goes to our failure to be candid with patients and talking about a difficult topic. Look, even as a legislator, it's a difficult topic. Believe me, it wasn't easy running for re-election saying, I want to talk about, he was a delegate, Morheim, what are you working on? I'd say, well, your death, the death of everybody you know, among other issues. And by the way, please vote for me in the next election. But you shared a really good story, Tom, about your father. And there are a lot of stories out there. And we need to be able to start telling those stories and talking to each other about this topic because it's a universal fact of life.
I'm interested, Shelley, in this, again, this notion of isolation when people are in the final moments. There's even a service that you guys write about in the book called No One Dies Alone, where people make it a point to be available and be with people as they are passing, if they are people who maybe don't have family or don't have friends in the area where they are or for whatever reason. Of course, obviously, a big crimp has been put in that hose during the pandemic. But as we get to greater rates of vaccination and the regulations in hospitals change, there's also, I think, some research that says, and my wife, who's was a journalist for the Baltimore Sun for many years, wrote about this decades ago, about at that very moment when people make that final passage, often they don't want anyone around. So family who have been hovering at the bedside for hours and days, whatever, oftentimes it's when they leave that bedside just momentarily that the person will pass away. And the thought is that people on some level don't want the people around. Do you have any thoughts about that?
I've certainly heard that, and those kinds of circumstances. I think it's more common that people do want to be surrounded by their loved ones, but sometimes they'll be surrounded by their loved ones, and it's the moment when everybody, you know, goes home for the night or, you know, takes a break that they will choose to, or, you know, that's when they pass, that's when they make the transition. So I think there's obviously variety among folks. But I think this, the pandemic has been, you know, by isolating people in these terrible illnesses and then often in death, it's been a real tragedy. And you kind of, you alluded to this also, it's really cut into our ability to grieve with others when someone dies. You know, we write about that in the book, how much a memorial service means to those who are left behind, even if it's very simple. It's just to give people a chance to say goodbye. And I know people have been very creative about how they are handling that, and which is great. But it's a real challenge. It's a real challenge to.
I think the other point, the point of the book is, whatever your values and desires are, you can express them. If you don't express them, no one knows, and things may happen that you may not like or may not want. But you can be completely flexible in how you write your advance directive and what you put in it, according to your own values and tastes. And not everybody's the same. Not everybody wants the same thing, depending even on the stages of their own life and their relationships and their spiritual evolution and so on. So it really is a living document. You can change it anytime you like, and there's no cost to it. So for a culture that talks about respecting individual rights and prerogatives, here we collectively don't complete free paperwork that emphasize that.
We have a comment from a listener who takes me to task in particular, and I think it's justified. It's a good point. She says, what I'm missing from this conversation is the positive expectation that we, the caregivers or the dying, would embrace this. Almost every participant's comments today give negative expectations. We're talking about how hard it is to talk about and the heebie-jeebies, etc. And Liz says, until we stop the negative vocabulary leading into these conversations, which in my opinion throws up an instant mental roadblock, it won't be considered a normal part of the public or private conversation. I think that's a good point. Shelley, what do you think?
I think that's a great point. And it's something we do write about in the book, that, you know, we need to make this part of just the natural, it's another natural part of life. It's not that people who are ill or dying or in mourning are not somehow outcasts, you know, of the larger society. It just is a natural thing that we all are going to go through at one point. There's also a profession that's come up of death doulas. You know, the doula is generally someone who helps a mother and parents through a birth experience. But there are people now offering to help people through the death experience.
What we'd like to see is that everybody, when they turn 18, complete an advance directive, and it becomes as part of as a routine as any of the other things. In fact, the three most famous cases in American medical legal history about end-of-life care decisions all involved women under 30, Cruzan, Quinlan, and Terry Schiavo. So it's not just for old people. Who knows what happens to anybody in this life, and what you choose when you're 18 or 28 or 38 or 58 or 88 will vary. But you do want to take care of this little bit of paperwork that takes a few minutes.
You can change it. You can update it. So if you have different feelings about the subject at 68 than you did when you wrote it at 18, you can simply make those changes. So, Dan, in our final few minutes here, you make a really good point in the book about how living wills, which are guides for healthcare agents, and other the people who are making decisions on your behalf if you're not able to, you talk about the fact that many medical decisions don't fall easily into recognizable categories. There's a whole bunch of stuff that is difficult to anticipate, isn't there?
Yeah, absolutely. Not only do clinical situations change, people change, the science changes. And so you have to be as flexible as possible in thinking about these issues. And there are very difficult decisions that come up. And one example is a senior person, say, with early dementia symptoms who breaks their hip. Do you fix the hip? You can't leave it unfixed, but you know it's going to be a very difficult course. Or when do you give antibiotics? How much? Or do you go, how much of a surgical procedure does one do? They're not easy answers for these things, but the more people have thought about them in advance and completed advanced directives, and another set of forms that are in Maryland called MOLST, medical orders for life-sustaining treatment, those forms really help direct clinicians to respect the values of the individual that they're taking care of. And as a clinician, that's what I want. I certainly give people as much medical information as I can, but ultimately the care decision is theirs, and I want to respect that. But if I don't know what it is, or if other people don't know what it is, then we're kind of out on a limb trying to make decisions, and I'd rather respect what people want. And that's really the whole purpose of the book, and I hope people will get the book. And I mentioned the website, www.thebetterend.com, available through the usual sources, Johns Hopkins Press, and in this case, the publisher, and Amazon. But this is a topic that we just want to have people feel more comfortable talking about it and overcoming that reticence and looking at the positive side, as the caller said.
And I do notice that hospitals now are asking people when they check in, even for minor surgeries or minor procedures, do you have an advance directive and is it on file here at this particular hospital? So it is, I think, becoming more, a normal or normalized part of the conversation about medical care, and that's a good thing. So in that way, things really have changed in the 10 years since your last book. So thanks to you both for writing the book and for coming on and talking about a very, very important subject. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you, Tom.
Dr. Dan Morheim is an emergency physician. Shelley Morheim is a filmmaker and an artist. Their new book is called Preparing for a Better End: Expert Lessons on Death and Dying for You and Your Loved Ones. Coming up, a psychologist who taught at the Harvard Medical School for more than 20 years joins me to talk about how the coronavirus pandemic has changed our perspective on life, death, and grieving. Dr. Dorothy Hollinger is the author of a book called The Anatomy of Grief. She joins me on the other side of this quick break. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
You're listening to your NPR News Station, 88.1 WYPR.